Goya presents Class of 79.
What seems to be the trouble, young fella?
I'm not sure. Can't get her started. But I'm not much of a mechanic, sir.
Well, maybe I can help you out. Why don't you kids hop aboard and we'll drop by the house with my tools. Well, it's just down the road a piece.
Well, we really appreciate that, Mr. Slauson.
My pleasure, Molly. My pleasure. Well, come on, kids. Come on.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turn 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and I'm excited to introduce Class of 79, the companion podcast to Class of 89. 1979 was an incredibly important year in horror. It's the year Fangoria Magazine was born, and it gave us movies like Phantasm, Alien, Salem's Lot, and Tourist Trap. Tourist Trap is the first movie we will cover on Class of 79, and our guest is Jocelyn Jones in her first recorded podcast interview ever. Jocelyn played Molly, the star of Tourist Trap, who sympathizes with Mr. Slauson, Chuck Connors, until she realizes he's killing off all of her friends and intends to keep her at Slauson's Lost Oasis forever with his precious collection of mannequins. Jocelyn explains why she cried the first time she read the script for Tourist Trap, her strange premonition about working with Chuck Connors, having to ask for a stunt adjustment on set, and why she looks batshit insane in the ending sequence, and a lot more. We'll get to Jocelyn's stories in just a minute, but first, I want to tell you about Fangoria Magazine. Fangoria Magazine is now a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Each issue includes set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, and minimal ads, all printed on collectible-grade paper stock that reimagines the classic magazine for a 2019 audience. You'll see familiar names like Michael Gingold and Tony Timpone, and you'll see bylines that will make your eyeballs pop out of your head like Barbara Crampton and S. Craig Zoller. And the best part? It's print only. Go to Fangoria.com to subscribe today. And I want to tell you about Terror Threads. Terror Threads is a horror apparel and accessory shop born out of a husband and wife's passion for all things spooky. Terror Threads' mission is to offer truly original t-shirts, pins, posters, and more that scream horror. Check out their original and licensed collections, including Sleepaway Camp, Terrifier, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Tourist Trap, just to name a few. See their entire selection at terrorthreads.com and take 10% off your order until June 30th with the discount code FANGO. That's F-A-N-G-O. Go to terrorthreads.com, discount code FANGO. Now, let's take a trip back to Slauson's Lost Oasis with Jocelyn Jones. Jocelyn, tell us about how you got into acting.
Well, you know, my father was an actor. My father was a character actor. He did Broadway, in the 40s and 50s. And then when television exploded in the 50s, they had stars and such, but they needed actors. So they were bringing all these Broadway actors out to L.A. And he and his friends would come out for sometimes months on end and do television shows. I think he did maybe 600 TV shows. I mean, it was an explosion of work and a lot of film. And, you know, he was a character actor that worked all of the time. So I grew up with it, and I really didn't want to be an actor. I thought, well, that's a very bad idea. One actor in the house is definitely enough. And I tried everything not to be an actor. And I was in New York. I was young. I sort of started out on my own pretty young, around 17. And I was in New York, and I was discovered by Eileen Ford, who was a wonderful, huge modeling agent of that time. And she saw something in me and, asked to work with me. And I started working with her. And I was a terrible model, it turns out. And she would, they send you out and you have these photographs taken. And so I would do that. And I was very uncomfortable. I thought the camera could sort of see through me. And I would bring her the pictures and she would say, oh, Jocelyn, no, it looks like they lined your family up against the wall and shot them. Oh. I mean, you look so sad. You know, nobody says, get me the sad girl. I want the sad girl. You have to do something about this. so, you know, I started to create characters just intuitively in order to be in front of the camera. So it wasn't me, you know. And so then she got those pictures and said, oh, you're an actor. And I went, no. And she said, no, yeah. And so she sent me out. On the first job, it was the Mayor Lindsay, the wonderful mayor of New York at the time, and he had a drug campaign because they had huge heroin problems at the time. And she sent me out on this commercial to be part of that campaign and play heroin addict.
What?
And I booked the job. And I, so every acting job, she would get these commercial, you know, kind of things. And, you know, be a period piece, and I would get that. So it was sort of apparent that the acting thing was there. So then I started to study, and I studied with really some of the greatest teachers in the world. I studied with Andy Meisner when he was at the Neighborhood Playhouse when he was teaching, and then came out here and studied with Lee Strasberg and then Milton Costello. So that was really my trajectory toward acting.
Did you enjoy it when you got into it, even though you had tried not to get into it?
No, I did. I did enjoy it. I mean, I remember at one point I was working on a Clint Eastwood film in San Francisco, and I was hitchhiking. I was a hitchhiker. I opened the film, and I'm on this mountain hitchhiking, and it's 76 degrees, cobalt blue sky.
Oh.
And I'm there with Clint Eastwood and these wonderful people on the crew because, you know, Clint Eastwood was incredible with his crew. So he would have a guy that was like the coffee guy, and 20 years later he was directing the film. So they would always sort of cut their arms off from him. He brought them along in the industry. And I thought, this is a job. But I remember thinking that, you know, in New York, I would go to the theater and see my father from the time I was 4 years old, and I would look at the theater and it was like a big dollhouse to me. You know, I would go, that's a job. You get to get in the dollhouse and play, you know, pretend. I said, that looks like a pretty good job to me.
So how did you get attached to Tourist Trap? Do you remember auditioning for that movie?
Well, you know, I didn't audition for that movie. That was the first time, you know, a script came that I didn't audition for.
Oh.
And, you know, now I'm going to say something sort of probably unpopular, but I'm not a horror movie fan. I'm one of those people I know, isn't it terrible? It's really terrible, but it's because I'm really, since I was a kid, I'm just really sensitive. You know, I don't like rides at amusement park. They're just too much for me. It's too much for me. And so, you know, really dark movies, you know, are not my cup of tea. So anyway, I read the script, and my now husband, as I've been with him for 40 years, was a beautiful man. Anyway, he walked into the room. I closed the script. And he walked into the room, and I started to cry. This is a terrible story.
Oh.
I started to cry, and he said, honey, what's the matter? And I said, oh, they're going to ask me to do this movie, and they're going to ask me to play the lead, and I'm going to do it. And he said, well, what is the matter with it? He said, well, it's a horror movie, you know. And it was supposed to be, they told me it was going to be Henry Fonda was going to play Mr. Slauson.
Oh.
But then Henry Fonda turned into Chuck.
Oh.
Which was really fine with me. I really enjoyed him. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I was at a time in my career I couldn't really turn down the lead in a film. So I did it, you know, and it was fun. It was much more fun making it than watching it. It scared me to watch it. You know, Woody gets in the throat of the thing, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's as someone who's not a horror fan, you signed up for one for sure.
Yeah. So I hope that wasn't a terrible thing to say on your
It's okay.
Podcast,
I think
horror movie.
I think the Fangoria audience will forgive you for that.
Oh, goody. I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
Your character Molly is so fascinating in Tourist Trap, and you and Chuck Connors, I think, really make that movie your dynamic. But let's start off with Molly. What inspiration did you draw upon to get into that character's headspace?
Well, Molly was very physical to me. First of all, she's not, you know, up until that point, I had, you know, played kind of sexy gals. And Molly was not sexy. She was, you know, shy and kind of introverted and, you know, didn't feel that she was a big part of the group. And so right away when I read Molly, weird things happen to actors, and it's different for each character. But I found her in my body, you know, her shoulders kind of collapsed a little. Her chest kind of sinks. She has a certain walk. She's, you know, it's hard to talk about, but I can feel her right now. You know, wow. She was very visceral, and you kind of entered her body in a certain way. That's not always how it goes, you know, with a part. Sometimes a pair of high heels will get you there. You know, that you walk in these shoes, and you go, oh, these shoes are, this is it, you know. So she kind of came to me in my body.
Fascinating.
And then I could just, once I felt her, I could go anywhere with her. She was timid and I wanted to protect her. You know, I felt like, poor Molly, this is, you know, everything was hard for her. And she didn't feel that she was really a part of the group as much as the others. You know how people are, that sometimes they feel, you know, like insecure and not part of the group and timid. And, you know, there's a lot going on in their head and they're, you know, so that was Molly.
Yeah,
but it was very interesting that right away her body, my shoulders do a whole thing, and my torso kind of contracts a little bit. She was a body hit.
Wow.
As they say.
She's enclosed. Like you're right. You are trying to protect her. She's very like closed off.
Yes.
To everyone else.
Yes.
And
exactly.
And that's why I think she really takes to Mr. Slauson, Chuck Connor's character, because she doesn't fit in with the other girls. And she kind of feels this weird kinship with Mr. Slauson. And that's a whole other relationship to get into in a second. But when you first got the job, did you talk to the director, David Schmoller, about the character and how you wanted to portray her? What were your conversations with him like?
You know, I what I remember is it was David's first film, and I worked with a number of directors on their first film, and it's very scary for directors on their first film.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't my first film, but I hadn't done all that much. But I was a very serious actor, and, you know, I had all these notes. So by the time I met with him, I had my notebook and my notes and my thing, and and it kind of, I think it winged him. I said, you should be directing this movie. So, you know, we do odd things when we were young, you know, and I think that my intention in those days was to appear as this very serious actor. In the end, you know, when I teach, I go, you know, a little insouciance goes a long way, a little lightheartedness, a little sense, spirit of play, you know, about things. But, you know, we were friends. I mean, I really like David. I think he's a terrific guy. But that's what I remember. It was kind of like, you should be directing this film. And it was kind of like, whatever I wanted to do was okay with him.
That's awesome. You had the full reign.
I kind of did. But, you know, also good directors hire actors who are going to deliver for them. That's what you're looking for in the room, you know. So you're directing a piece and 15 actors come in and one comes in and you see that they're, even if they haven't worked, you know, they have a very professional attitude, they have a confidence, they're taking on the part right away, and they're delivering what you want for that part or what you didn't imagine and have now fallen in love with for that part. What's weird to me is now that I think I've never thought of this is that, you know, I've done the lead in this film, the Great Texas Dynamite Chase, which is also a cult film.
Right.
And that's what David had seen. And that gal is a little kind of sexy little thing. So I think, I don't know whether maybe David had a different vision for Molly and I brought in that timid girl. But, you know, there's also a thing in acting where if all those people are going to play that, then I need to play something different. And and I intuitively felt that she needed to be, not a bass note, but, you know, another note. And then, you know, Pino made that music for, you know, the other thing I realized is I made a choice that it was a love affair because You know, there are very few choices in movies, and one of them, is it a love affair? Right. Is there some kind, because there's all kinds of love stories, you know, is there some kind of love story going on, or some kind of fight going on, or some kind of, you know, there's only a few things out there, and then there's a trillion variations of those things. And so that whole love story element, I don't know that it was in the script, it might have been, but we certainly brought it up, and then the music was extraordinary.
Pino DiMaggio.
I thought the music, in many ways, he made the film.
Yes.
With that music.
And I think a lot of the budget went to Pino, actually, for his score. Yeah. And it just makes the whole film. It has this, like, quirky, ominous vibe to it, and it's just as perfect, really.
Yeah, it set the tone for it. You know, sometimes a picture is a little toneless, and then a composer will come in and set the tone for it. The same thing happened with Texas Dynamite Chase and Craig. I can't remember his last name. He's so fabulous, but he's gone on to be a huge, huge scorer. And the same thing happened. You know, the film came alive with his score.
Yeah.
And the tone of it locked in.
Yes, the music absolutely, totally makes it. And Tourist Trap is no exception to that. And that's really interesting what you said, that you brought this kind of love to Molly and Mr. Slauson, because it's kind of an unconventional relationship that happens in a few hours. And
Well, it happens the first moment. Love affairs always happen in the first moment. And if you look at the first time I see him or say hello or something and I'm all doe-eyed, I wanted that. I wanted her to be taken with him.
You can definitely
like a
tell.
Father figure, you know?
Yes.
And the first moment is very important. If you're going to play that, then you want that note because, you know, particularly in storytelling, love happens at the first moment. So you want to define that as an actor. What is that moment?
Wow. And you can really see that when the first time you see him, when you're all getting into the little, you know, oasis in there and he comes by and the other girls are kind of scared of him, but you're taken with him.
Yeah.
And that's just amazing. And I have to know, like, what was it like working with Chuck Connors, you know, opposite Chuck Connors in a movie?
Well, this is the funny thing about that, because I'd done Great Texas Dynamite Chase, and my co-star was Johnny Crawford.
True. You've had some legends.
And then I'll tell you, this is the strangest thing. You probably, you know, whether you believe it or not, I had a dream before I did either of those movies one night. And I remember telling someone, I had a dream that I was with Chuck Connor and Johnny Crawford in maybe one of those wagons that they went across the country in 18, whatever.
No way.
And I did. And the only reason I remember it is I thought, that's the strangest dream. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just didn't know. And then later in my life, it was like, and I didn't pick up on it with Johnny. But then when I was going to work with Chuck, I went, oh my God, I had that dream.
That's so crazy.
So right away we had a connection because of course he loves Johnny and I just saw that film and he's just, you know, Chuck was a really tremendous guy. He was just very easy and very respectful and very complimentary of my work and we played together. He got it immediately with the, you know, that they should be connected because he was definitely paying love stories. That was in the piece that, you know, he's missing his wife.
Right, right. Wow, that's amazing that you had that dream, like a premonition that you would work with these two legends.
Yeah, very, very odd, very odd.
Wow. So did you and Chuck discuss how you would do certain scenes or did it kind of develop naturally? What was that process like?
You know, you rehearse. So you bring to the rehearsal, you know, and an actor, if you're working on a film, you've made choices and taken notes and, you know, you're prepared. You're bringing something to the party. And so, you know, we'd rehearse and it's wonderful because when you're working with an actor that you really respect, you bring to the party and then you see what they bring to the party. It's kind of a surprise, you know, and then you give each other, you know, these gifts. And so if you love that the actor is prepared and they're doing that kind of work, it's very fun. it's just kind of stand out of the way because anything can happen. And then you go with whatever happens in the moment with each other. You trust that. And so, yeah, we really enjoyed that process.
I love seeing you guys together and the arc that Molly and Mr. Salson go on throughout the film, because it gets pretty, visceral towards the end. And I'd love to know, like, you have some pretty emotional scenes. Like, what place did you have to put yourself in? Like, take, for instance, the ending when, you know, Mr. Salson kidnaps Molly and he's not going to let her go. And she's forced with the reality that she's never going to leave again. Or she has to escape somehow and we'll have to kill him. How did you even get into that spot? Because your emotions are so raw.
Well, I'm going to tell you a secret about that sort of thing in acting. You know, emotional scenes like that, in a funny way, are the easiest scenes to play because you have to jump off a cliff. Mm. You know what I mean? There's no, you can't, you're prepared, you know, she's trapped, you know. There's also the immediate environment you're in. We were in an attic that must have been 110 degrees. You know, there's a lot of sweat on both of us. If you see, I remember we were very hot and sweaty, and you just go, you know, with that kind of a thing, you're going to hatchet him to death, and you just jump off the cliff and let it fly. And people, you know, are the most impressed with those big emotional scenes. But for an actor who, you know, has a kind of ability, they're the easiest. Because you have to, they're so extreme, you have to leap. Harder is to play the girl next door. Harder is to play the simple, quiet scene that's filled with a lot of, you know, smaller innuendo, you know.
Right.
Storytelling, smaller storytelling points are more complicated in the preparation of them, you know, like a moment, like the first moment, the love moment, or, you know, just those kinds of moments. Simpler moments are trickier sometimes.
Gotcha. Yeah, because you really dove off that deep end, because I can see the scene in my mind over and over again when you finally kill Mr. Slauson. And there's a couple beats after that where you kind of have mentally realized, you know, well, Molly has mentally realized what she's done. And she just lets out the scream. That
oh,
is
this
so
scream.
Fantastic. It's so fantastic. And it's one of the best screams, I think, in horror cinema, hands down. Because it is so just like bursting with like, oh my God, what just happened?
You know, you can't, you either go or you don't.
Right.
You have to
you
go.
Went. You went, Jocelyn.
Go. Yeah. That's what I was hired for.
There's a couple other scenes that I just think are fascinating. There's the end, of course, that is just so bizarre. And it features you driving away with your mannequin friends in the car.
Oh.
And it's kind of just like the WTF moment. Like, what? What is happening? Do you remember filming that scene?
Oh, I sure do. Because that was, I got to set and I can't remember. Something happened. And suddenly, and maybe it was that we were in a place where David could kind of steal that shot. You know, sometimes with the locations, it's like, whoa, this road is perfect for the thing, you know.
Right.
Anyway, there was a change. I arrived on set and he said, it was the first day, and he said, and he was really nervous. And he said, you know, I'm really sorry, Jocelyn, but, you know, we're going to shoot the last scene. I said, I'm sorry. You know, I was, you know, a little bratty, but anyway, I'm sorry. You didn't tell me we were shooting. I mean, seriously, you're going to shoot the last scene first? And I'm not even prepared for that. I mean, look at that. That's David, you know. And he said, well, and I can't remember what the excuse. And I went, okay, fine. So I went and, you know, went into hair and makeup and, you know, just started on this film. And I thought, okay. So I thought, well, you know, that thing in the attic and, you know, I kill him and now all of my friends are like a mess and puppets. And I'm driving. So I decided, you know, you have to make a choice. You have to come with something. And I couldn't figure out anything else. And then I finally went, I know. I'm obviously out of my mind. Right. Because I just thought I was on a little road trip, and now I've killed a guy with a hatchet, and all my friends are dead. So I'm going to pretend that it's my birthday party, and I'm 7 years old, and my friends are in the back seat, and we're going to my birthday party, and I'm so happy. And that's why I look insane.
Wow. That is an amazing backstory, because you're right. Like, when the ending, and it just ends on a freeze frame of your face.
Yeah, and I look a little crazy.
You look a little crazy.
I look a little crazy. Quite crazy. Yeah.
Wow, that is fascinating. I've always been intrigued by that ending, and it is kind of a curveball, a perfect curveball at the end, mm-hmm. because it's just mm-hmm. so left field that it works.
Exactly.
Are there any moments in particular that you remember when you look back at the production of that film that stand out to you, that you really remember as being just good or bad memories?
Well, there was quite a night. There was a night the day that we worked in the water. You know, I was there with the other girls, and, you know, we did a whole bunch of scenes, and we were in the water. And then Chuck arrives, and we say hi, and they're scared, and I'm intrigued. And then everybody got out of the water and went home. But then Chuck and I had to go into the water at night again.
Right.
There's that scene where he comes up behind me. And so I had been in the water all day and all night. And I was wearing that stupid little white dress, which was clinging to me and making me very, very cold. And, you know, we got everything done, and you're a pro about all that. And you say, oh, I'll tell the story later. But anyway, we were wrapped. You know, David called wrap, which means, you know, the day is over. And I can't tell you how much I wanted to hear those words that day. It was very happy to hear, that's a wrap. And I went, oh, God, thank God. And, you know, the makeup people and the wardrobe people are so wonderful. And they're often very motherly and very protective. And so I went back to the trailer, and what's her name? I think it was Christine something. Anyway, she was the wardrobe girl, and she had the hot water running. You know, she had a shower, and I came in, and she gave me a shot of whiskey, and she didn't get sick and get in the hot shower. So I'm in the hot shower on my second shot of whiskey, and there's a knock on the door. And she went to the door, and it was the second AD, I think, and he said, you know, they didn't get the shot, so, you know, we need her back in the water.
Oh, no.
And this woman was fantastic. She was like, no, you called her up. You know, you guys are just amateurs. You called her up. You can't, you know, no. She's in the shower. It's over. She's been in that water for 12 hours. Anyway. This went on. I mean, the second, and then the first came, and he said, you know, David really wants her back in the water. It won't take a long time. Doesn't have to be a big deal. Just get her out of the shower, get her in clothes, get her in the water, blah, blah, blah. And she said, there's no way she's doing it. And then I arrived at that point and said, what's going on? They want you to go back in the water. They're not going back in the water. And I went, oh. And now I said, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, right there. In the hot shower, and I've now had two shots of whiskey, which I don't even drink, you know. And then David and a producer came, and then David came. I swear to God, it was like, you know, another one. And finally they sent Chuck in, and Chuck said, you know, I'm willing to do it if you're willing to do it. And I said, Chuck, you're in a wetsuit. You know, I'm in this stupid little cold, you know, wet dress.
Oh.
And he said, you know, it's best for the film. And I said, I don't know. And she sent him away. And then she looked at me. She said, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to ask for a stun adjustment. And I said, what's a stun adjustment? She said, never mind, just ask. I went, okay. So now they all come in. She says, come in. And I go, okay, I'll get back in the water, but I need a stun adjustment. No idea what it's talking about. And they went, okay. And then they left, and you could hear them outside the camera going, what's a stun adjustment? Oh, stun adjustment. It's such a point. Just give her the freaking stun adjustment. Just give it to her. And they went, okay. So we go back in the morning. We get the shot. 6 months later, I get this sizable check in the mail.
Ah.
Sizable check. And I call my agent. I go, why? What is this check? And he goes, that's your stunt adjustment, baby.
That was smart.
I didn't know what a stunt adjustment was, but it was probably appropriate as well.
Oh, yeah. I think you deserve that for being in the water for like 16 hours in a freezing cold, almost nothing gown.
Yeah. It's true.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, it does show there are some uncomfortable, you know, scenes. Like, you guys are running through the woods. You're being chased by, how tall was Chuck Connors? Like 6'5" or something?
Yeah. He's very tall. Very tall.
So
Woody, everybody's like, let's split up and find Woody. Woody! You know,
yeah, great device. Idea.
Yeah, good idea. Let's split up so we can get killed one by one.
Yeah, well, that's the premise of every horror movie, pretty much.
Yeah,
so.
I guess, right? I don't know. I don't watch them, but I figured
you
that
have
out.
To split up.
Yeah, to split up.
Were you kind of freaked out by mannequins after doing Tourist Trap? Were they freaky on set, or were they just kind of goofy? Did you guys?
They weren't that freaky. What was freaky to me is I was so thrilled I didn't have to have a mask. You know, I didn't have to go in cement or whatever they did with those life masks because I'm kind of claustrophobic. So
that
I was like,
terrible.
Oh, I don't want to do that. You know, so I was really happy I didn't have to do that. And I felt for the people who did, but yeah, it was very effective. You know, in life, they're like, oh, that's kind of silly. But, you know, on film, they were very effective, I think.
Do you have any other memories from the set that you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, the other thing I just flashed on was the gun. You know, I don't like guns. Mm. You know, horses and guns, they're all the time in movies. They're going, you're going to ride a horse. I go, really? I don't really ride horses. Yeah, you're going to ride a horse. Okay.
Okay.
And guns, you're going to shoot a gun. I don't really like guns. Well, you're going to shoot a gun. So, you know, there's that scene where I have a shotgun or something pointed at Chuck, and I really did not like that. And the gun guy, there's a guy whose whole job is gun.
Right.
And he, you know, said, okay, so it's got a, you know, a point, like wad in it or whatever the load was, you know, the fake load, and it had a number or something. And he told me, he said, so, you know, it's going to be fine. So just, you know, shoot it. And I go, no, I'm not here to shoot. You shoot it, you know. And you show me that that's okay. I'm not just going to do that, pointed at Chuck. You do it and show me that it's fine. And then I'll do it. And he did it, and it wasn't fine.
Oh, no.
I mean, it didn't hurt Chuck, but it was awful. It was too much. It was scary. It scared everybody.
Mm.
So I went, oh, okay, that's a little too much. And so then
Jeez.
He lowered it. And I just made him, you know, then I got very interested. Okay, what's the load and how much and where do you put it? And okay, do that number load and you shoot it. And then let me show you that you're doing exactly the same amount. And then I'll shoot it. And then we, you know.
Wow. So did Chuck feel it on the when that happened?
I don't. He was definitely like, whoa, dude. Too much there. You know, so nobody got hurt, but it was too much. It was too much.
Wow. Too much for Chuck Connors.
Yeah.
Well, that's too much for anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. Too much for anyone. And everybody knows, you know, those stories about people getting hurt with guns.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You can't be cavalier. And also, you know, I was aware that I was on an independent set with a first-time director. And
right.
You know, it's another thing, you know, on the Eastwood picture, you work on those films and, you know, I had to do some kind of, it was not really a stunt, but I had to get shot and leap backwards and then fall down, and they have mattresses and they show, and then the stunt guy comes and he makes you do it 20 times and then he adjusts it for you. You know, he moved to the, I don't know, I was pulling to the left or pulling to the right or something. And he said, you know, we're going to move the mattress. And I said, oh, no, it's okay. I won't pull. I'll make, he said, no, you're pulling. Your job is to do what you do. And my job is to cover you. So we're going to move the mattress. I went, okay.
Okay.
Fine. Move the mattress. But yeah, you know, you're very aware that you're working with these top pros, and the gun guy was fine. I'm sure he was, you know, all pro, but you know, it's a low budget film, and so people haven't had the experience. And right. When it comes to guns, you want to be pretty careful about that stuff.
Yeah, that was definitely smart on your part to have him test it out first.
Yeah.
So Jocelyn, when was the first time that you saw Tourist Trap, and what were your thoughts on it?
I think probably, I don't really remember, but I'm quite sure it must have been the premiere. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember seeing it. I do remember thinking that the music had just done wonders, that it looked much better than I expected, and that the music was great and had set a tone, you know. I'm not very comfortable. This is why I don't remember, because I'm really not comfortable watching myself on film, particularly with an audience of people. I'm kind of oddly shy about certain things, and that made me shy.
I feel like that's a lot of actors.
I went to a screen, you know, the opening of Great Texas Dynamite Chase, and afterward I was just kind of blind. I kept, you know, sort of a big party thing afterwards, and you know, I kept turning to my husband saying, can we go now? And he kept saying, no honey, you can't go now, you're the star of the movie, you can't go. And I go, okay. And so then I'd say hello, hi, and then I turned to my husband, can I go now? And he said, no, just a little while longer. Let's say hello to these people and those people. And so, you know, he was great. He walked me through it.
Aww.
And the next morning he said to me, so honey, you know, weren't you excited when, you know, Jeff Bridges came up and told you how much he loved the new in the movie? And I went, what?
Oh, jeez.
Jeff Bridges came and he was like, said, telling you how much he loved you in the film. And I said, really? What did I do? He said, you kind of blew him off.
Oh my gosh, you blew Jeff Bridges off.
Well, I worked with Bo a couple of times. So I would have been very friendly had I, you know, had my eyeballs in my head. But, kind of I don't like think it was in my body at the time.
An outer body experience for sure.
Yeah, those things are a little outer body experiences for me.
Let's talk about what you're working on right now. What are you excited about doing?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different things going on right now. I'm going to start with, interestingly, in the last year, I have been asked to act again in two films. Mm-hmm. So that's bizarre. The first was a film called Second Son. It's a post-World War II, kind of a poem, this film. Very beautiful. It started out as a play, so it's kind of a play of a film. Very, very low budget. My friend directed it and asked me to do it, and they're just in the process now of selling it, and it's going to open in New York and LA, I think, in the next 6 months now. And then I did a second one called Diary. It's a thriller. You know, about an abused girl who plays my niece. Terrible things have happened to him, so she has a split personality.
Oh.
Right up your alley.
Yeah, I was going to say, hey, this is coming from the girl who doesn't like horror movies.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's kind of a thriller. I actually did not want to do this, so she talked me into it. And she talked me into it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. But yeah, terrible things happen to her, and she becomes two personalities. She's an Instagram model in one personality, and an assassin in the other personality.
Ooh.
And I play her aunt. Her parents are all dead, and I'm the only one who knows all of the secrets.
That sounds really fascinating. I like that. I want to see that when it comes out.
Yeah. So that's going on. And also, I'm doing a lot of writing. You know, I have two screenplays and a play and a TV show, and I've kind of taken some time to get involved in that.
Wow,
and I'm moving on to other things. I think you're going to ask about the studio. So
tell us about the Jocelyn Jones Acting Studio.
Well, so here's the thing. I taught at the Beverly Hills Playhouse for Milton Katselis for about 17 years.
Wow.
And he was quite a teacher. He was a remarkable teacher. And he had, having studied with the people I'd already studied with, I was quite impressed with him because he had this kind of meat and potatoes technique. And I started teaching for him pretty early on. You know, again, the acting thing, you know, I liked it. You know, if people offered me a job, I would do it. But I didn't like the lifestyle of going out and auditioning. And I just wasn't crazy about it. And I was a teacher. So I was about to have a child. And teaching and mothering seemed to go pretty well together. I did my last acting job at 9 months pregnant.
Wow.
On a Cagney and Lacey. Oh, and then man. I became a teacher. And I was sort of made for that. Teaching has a calling. And, you know, I have a whole history that's too long to tell you about teaching. But I didn't like a lot of teachers. Oh, God, that I became one. But I became a teacher. And then after all those years of teaching at the Beverly Hills Playhouse, I was lured away by some outer stratospheric movie stars. I started working with film stars, you know, with the, I had NDA, just, you know, can't talk about it and can't mention their name.
Right.
So I have the best credits in the world, but I can't use them.
You just can't tell anyone.
Yeah. But I branched out in that work, you know, at some point. I was doing everything from helping to pick material to working on scripts. I'm a script doctor. So I would script doctor things. I would help rebuild the structures of them and then do everything from, you know, I would like me. But to work for me, you know, I mean, they would go on set and they would open their script and they would have 3 months of developed notes. So the scene would be on one side and the notes would be on the other side. I'd do everything from the research. I'd sort of discover what they needed to excite them with the character.
Oh, wow.
And deliver that. And I would work on a picture with a star for 3 months, 4 months, you know, behind the scenes. So I did that for about 7 years. And then I just felt like I couldn't do that anymore. You know, movie stars can be a little challenging.
Yeah.
And so I stopped doing that. I took a year off and, you know, something happened and I was like, okay, that's it. I can't do this anymore. Mm. And I came home and sort of licked my wounds and I told my husband, that's it. I can't work. I don't care who the movie star is, who they are. I'm not doing that work anymore. Plus, you know, I spent 7 years, I had no credit. So it was as if I hadn't worked at all. I didn't like that. I didn't like the lack of generosity in acknowledging, you know, my contribution to these films. So, you know, the phone rang. After I said, there's no one on the planet, no one that I would do that work with, the phone rang and it was, I can say his name because I just talked to him today. It was Forrest Whitaker.
Oh, wow.
And I looked at Miles and went, well, geez, I can't, you know,
it's
I have
Forrest
to
Whitaker.
Meet Forrest Whitaker. Are you kidding? After I said, there's nobody. Oh, really? Well, how about Forrest? So Forrest called and, we did quite a bit of work together for another maybe, I don't know, 6-7 years. We did a number of projects together. I'm very, very fond of him. He's a beautiful human being. Mm-hmm. And he's the first one of those stars who, you know, he gave me credit. Not in the early ones, but for The Butler. He gave me a credit on The Butler. He never told me about it.
Aww.
I think he called me his dramaturge or something. But I went to the opening, you know, the premiere, and it was such a beautiful film, and I loved him in it, and I loved the film, and you know, I was watching it and standing at the end and clapping, and all of a sudden I saw my name on screen and went, oh my God.
Oh, what a nice moment.
Such a beautiful, generous thing to do. So that was that, and then Miles came to me and said, I think you should teach again. This actually happened before Forrest because Bars wanted to come to class, and I said, you know, there are a lot of working actors in there, but no, that's not going to work out. you can't really rehearse the way I, you know, it wasn't going to work out. So, my husband came to me and said, I think you should teach again. And I said, are you crazy? I did that, really. I just want to write. I'm just in my room writing. Leave me alone. But he was funny about it. He thought, you know, no, you know, I don't think you're done with that. And I think you should have your own studio. Mm-hmm. And it was really Miles, who was the director. He directed television. And he's the one. That studio wouldn't have been there except for him because he said, you know, I'll run it. And wow. It's just a class. It's not a school. We're just going to do a class. So it was at a dinner, and I said, I don't know. I'm not going to advertise. I've never advertised. I don't like that. And my daughter said, Facebook, Mom. And I said, isn't that a dating app? You know, I just, I'm not my generation. Not a kind of college dating app or something. She said, no. And so she really created the studio page, and we put out kind of a letter of interest, you know, about a class. And I had taught for so many years and had so many students, and they didn't know about who I was working for even. They were just going on the when I had been a teacher. Anyway, that first class filled in 3 or 4 weeks. It was crazy. It was like when the universe says, yes, this is what you should do. So we had 50 people, you know, I always knew I was going to cap it at 50 people. And then we started a second class, and that was 50 people. And so the studio was always 100 actors, and it was pretty much always full. We always had a wait list. And they were all handpicked. I interviewed everybody.
Wow.
And they were mostly working. I mean, no, one of the classes became sort of the working actors class because they needed a place to work with each other. And then they were like, oh, my God, we have all these working actors to play with. And then the other classes, maybe, you know, coming along. I actually loved working with beginners. But that has evolved. About 2 years ago, my mother called and said, you know, come home, I'm dying. And so I left on a dime, and I left the studio. And, you know, my students are great. I mean, I wrote them and told them and said, look, I don't know how long this is going to be, but I'm going to put the studio in hiatus. So it took a year to sort of say goodbye to her. And then, you know, there was a family home and stuff and all that had to be dealt with. And that took about a year. And then I was sent. I was just needed some time to regroup. And so that's when we rented a little apartment in New York so we could be bi-coastal. And I started writing and just started spending time with myself on what are the possibilities for my life now? You know, what direction am I going to go in? So I did that for a year. And now I'm reopening the studio in a very different way. I'm not going to go back to regular classes. I have a intensive, an 8-week intensive coming up in the summer, August and September. And, but it's just 16 actors, and that filled immediately because they know it. And they were all students I'd worked with before, and they're all working actors. And they just thought, oh, we'll get her for like just alone for 16 people. So we're going to do that. And then in October, I'm going to do a weekend seminar about sort of the evolution of where the teaching has gone. You know, in the beginning, you know, Milton had this great technique, and I really took that into the studio. I feel every actor should have a technique. But over the many, many, many years I've taught, it's become it's always been my bend that acting was actually a very spiritual endeavor. And that I've often said to actors, you know, you're the high priest of art, because, you know, you represent the human condition. So if you can do this and create life so that you do this so well, and you create life in front of people's eyes, and you do it so well that they forget that they're an audience member and they enter the piece as part of the piece, you know, that's what happens when people act really well. People forget they're watching.
Right,
they're kind of invested and in there. And then, you know, the people clap and they leave the theater. And somewhere in them, they think, my God, if that person can create life before my very eyes, surely I can create a little better in my own life.
Oh, wow.
That's what I hear that you're doing for people. So that's the kind of thing I'm interested in now. I work with actors. I tell them, you know, you're not your talent. Actors, you know, they get very kind of self-involved. And so I try to help them out of their ego. I go, you know, you're not your talent. They don't love hearing that. But I said, you're not your talent. You have a tremendous gift. This is true. But your gift is that you vibrate on a higher level. You vibrate on a very high level in order to ask these questions in this technique and have the answers come in a very visceral way. And that way you're channeling something from outside into the work. This may be way too airy-fairy for you, but...
Oh, no, it's fascinating.
That's what I'm interested in. So that's what I'm writing a book about. That's what I'm going to be doing some seminars and public speaking about.
I have just one more question for you before I let you go. It's a question that I ask all of our class of 79 graduates, and that is, what advice would you give yourself 40 years ago?
You know, I think I would have to say meditate. Mm. If I had started meditating 40 years ago, I would be further along in co-creating my life with the universe, so to speak. Mm. So when you meditate and you get that little bit of separation I was talking about, you separate out from your thoughts a little bit, you become the observer, it gives you time to choose, you know, how you're going to proceed forward. And people, this whole law of attraction thing, I know people think it's airy-fairy. I'm sorry, it's the way the universe works. Mm-hmm. What you think you are, you know, have you ever noticed, like, when you really, you know, when 40 years ago, I was a bratty actor, you know, and I complained a lot, you know, like, I'm doing the thing, and she's no good, and he's no, whatever we do, you know what I mean? And then I wondered why people didn't like me, you know, or you say, oh, I'm never going to get a job, and then you don't work. And you say, it's just as simple as I've lost my keys. I've learned, like, if you say you've lost your keys, you know, that's an hour right there. You're not going to find your keys. But if you say, oh, where are my keys? And you clear your mind, I guarantee you, just practice that. You'll come up with your keys within, you know, 45 seconds. So it's very simple. These things are very simple. I think I'm going to write about in my book about simplicity really is the language of masters.
Mm.
So if you can just bring it down to the simple thing of, oh, I'm not thinking very positively right now, I think I'll change that. Or, oh, I'm kind of operating out of fear there, I think I'll change that. Oh, I'm not liking that person. That must mean, you know, I've done something as bad to them as they've done to me. Otherwise, I wouldn't care. So I'm going to send them. I'm just going to think about them in a more loving manner and wish them well in my heart, you know.
Wow.
This changes lives. This is, you can have whatever life you want. And it is as simple as envisioning it, staying positive, taking actions every day toward it. And then you let the universe do the rest. They're the ones who, like, sit you down in the seat next to somebody and you go, I can't believe I just sat down next to exactly the person that I, you know, those things happen to us all the time. When those things happen to us, they are acknowledgement that you're operating correctly.
It's such a pleasure to talk to you, Jocelyn. I've learned so much.
I feel
so enlightened and just very inspired by everything that you talked about. And it was a bonus, really, to hear about your time on Tourist Trap. I think it was such a unique perspective, and I know our audience appreciates your role as Molly in that movie, and now we can appreciate what you're doing right now and your message, and that's just great. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been just such a pleasure talking to you, Natasha. Thank you for reaching out to me. I really enjoyed it.
We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pacetta, executive producers Dallas Sonier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavamare, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pacetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.